Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to former New York Post reporter Kieran Crowley. He recently expanded his literary output from true crime nonfiction to untrue crime fiction, with a wild peek behind the curtain of Big Apple tabloid newspaper publishing, Hack. Stick around. The names have been changed to protect the innocent author from the guilty protagonists. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of reporters, editors, veterinarians, and chefs who already read Hack and think they have a case against the author for malicious parody in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. There are certain cultures in the Western world that we really know very little about. The Church of Scientology, for example, Justin Bieber, and the tabloid journalism world of Rupert Murdoch, from Fox News to the New York Post. How do any of these three consistently get away with what they do? I try to ignore the first two as much as possible, but the third never fails to evoke my curiosity and offend my sensibilities. I was fascinated by Joe Muto's ugly yet funny behind-the-scenes Fox News tell-all, An Atheist in the Foxhole. And I couldn't put down former New York Post reporter Kieran Crowley's fiction, Hack, which probably is painfully honest in its portrayal of how the news really comes together at tabloid papers such as The Post and the New York Daily News. Hack is hysterically disturbing in its brutal reveal of the kind of backstabbing fights over exclusives and sometimes ethics-free reporting practices at the tabloids. Parts of it might seem like science fiction if we didn't already know that the Murdoch empire in particular is rife with phone hacking. Crowley already made a name for himself with a series of best-selling true crime books, including Sleep My Little Dead, Burned Alive, and The Surgeon's Wife. But I have no doubt he can make a living from writing fiction going forward, and personally, I hope to read many more tales of Hack's war hero reporter, Francis X. Shepard, soon. Kieran Crowley, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thanks, Bob. Pleasure to be here.
Good to have you. I try very hard to read my guests' books before they come on, and then I try with fiction not to read to the end, and that way I won't make the mistake of giving something away inadvertently.
But spoiler alert,
yes,
right.
But I will admit I got to 10 pages till the end and I was I still didn't know who done it and I kept reading. So I'm going to be put myself on my honor to keep my mouth shut about things.
Well, praise indeed if you couldn't put it down, so thank you.
I really enjoyed it. I really did. I won't mess around with that. And now, what I really want to know, though, is after reading Hack, how many of your past coworkers want to kill you, and how many want to give you the Purple Heart for bravery?
I haven't had any death threats yet. This is, of course, a work of fiction, and any resemblance to real people or organizations is entirely coincidental, as we know, Bob.
Yes.
You have to go places, and like, what if? And I went there and I think went beyond that, and I was trying to have fun with it.
Oh, it seemed like you had a good time.
You can't have fun with cannibalism and serial killing. What can you have fun with?
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. It's a great mix of kind of fun concepts, like you say, the cannibalism. There's some great action in there when Shepard gets locked in the trunk of a car, and you know how he deals with that. I really thought that was going to be the end of the book. I mean, I knew intellectually that I still had.
Well, it almost was, but you know, spoiler alert, right?
I mean, intellectually, I knew that I still had a whole bunch of pages yet to read, but I just thought, how the hell do you get out of this one? I mean, it just, I don't know. I mean,
that's what, yeah, I love that. I love the paper bag thing. You know, like you can't write your way out of a paper bag. It's like you put your guy in something and say, he can't, how's he going to get out of this? And to figure that out, I love doing that. You know, and it's sometimes it's not easy, but it comes up. You come up with surprises, and the characters take you places that you didn't know you were going, and that's when it really clicks. That's when you're in the zone.
How much of your experience covering real crime, true crime, police reporting, and all that kind of stuff for a Metropolitan Daily helps you to be able to think kind of out of the box in terms of, you've probably seen all kinds of insanely crazy situations. Does that make it easier to imagine, you know, this
guy? Basically, my research is already done, and it's in my brain already. So, and I've forgotten more than most people know about, you know, covering that stuff. And, you know, you work with cops, and you work with firefighters, and you work with people in various lines of work, and you see people on their best days in their life and on the worst days in their life. And so you meet some people who you'll never talk to because they're dead. And, you know, the way different cops deal with that, and the way they investigate it, and the way everybody deals with it, and the way reporters compete over it, you know, is what it's all about.
You have, I'm, you know, I didn't write this down, so correct me if I'm wrong. You have a cop named Izzy, who I think is Jewish Puerto Rican.
Yes. Right?
He's got an interesting.
He's really a New York kind of guy.
Yeah, he's definitely. And he has a very interesting way of. He's a detective, and he's got an interesting way of dealing with homicides. You want to maybe describe that a little bit?
Well, yes, he interviews the dead people. He talks to the dead people. When it was, as he's reading the crime scene, he basically talks out loud. This is his way of thinking. And he doesn't just say, well, you know, the gun is here or the knife is there, so that must mean so-and-so. He talks to the person, because remember, the cop hasn't met this person either. And now that cop has the responsibility that they take very seriously, and in some cases religiously, they are going to get justice for that person. And so it's kind of introducing yourself to the victim and trying to figure out who they were, what they did, and especially what the bad guy did, so they can find out who the hell it is.
There are a lot of writers who work in this kind of genre of fiction where it's like it's sort of true crime, but it's funny. Carl Hiaasen comes to mind. That school of
he's great, yeah.
And yet in those stories, most of Hiaasen's books, I think, or even he just passed, the Detroit writer. Get Shorty. Why can't I think of his name? I've read all of his books.
Elmore Leonard.
Thank you. The police don't necessarily come off as very smart in those books. What I noticed particularly about your book is you seem to have a great respect for the police. You treat them.
Oh, yeah.
They're one of the few professionals in the book.
Yeah, right. Who actually care about what they do and are doing it and are not just out for themselves. Yeah, because they got a job to, and they do take it seriously. Look, they're. You know, you got 40,000 cops in New York City. You got a lot of different people. You got screw ups, just like in any profession. But, you know, most of these guys take their job very seriously, especially homicide detectives, because they're at the top of their profession and they're there for a reason. And, you know, it's an awesome responsibility. Imagine if you've worked as a reporter, you said you were doing police beat in Jersey. I mean, imagine if it was your responsibility. You had to find the person who did this so you could go back to the parents of the victim and say, I got justice for your daughter. Imagine that. That's the kind of thing that keeps you awake at night.
But generally, in fiction, cops in real life tend to look down their nose at a lot of reporters who they think are idiots and who just, you know, are waiting for handouts and don't do the work. And so a lot of times, yep. I think the reporters who turn novelists, Hiaasen, for example, they treat the cops the way the cops treat reporters. They're you know, they're they're just a, basically they're hacks, exactly. Did you have particularly good experiences as a reporter with cops? Is that what I'm seeing reflected in this book?
Yeah, we've all had a few bad experiences, but yeah, no, I've had very good experiences, you know, working with detectives in the city, on Long Island, and elsewhere, and at different levels, not just the local level. And once an investigator knows that you have similar priorities and will not burn them, you know, because there are things that cops have to realize burns us as a reporter, and vice versa. When I would find evidence at a crime scene after the cops had left, I would contact the cops involved. I would call the detectives involved and tell them, so they could basically come back and you know, cover it. When at Gus Faraci's execution scene, I found another round in his sunglasses by tracing the ricochet, and I found his sunglasses under the car. I didn't touch them and put my fingerprints all over them and embarrass them in the media by saying, we found it first. And, you know, sometimes you can't help that because other people film you doing it. And, you know, that happened on Long Island a couple of years ago when I found some stuff in a case that led to the arrest of someone for the death of an old woman. Who police originally didn't charge anybody for, but they know that, you know, because I'm so old in terms of when I started this job, I remember when cops and reporters were on the same side. And so that is still possible, that can still happen, but it's much more the exception now, because cops, there are a lot of reporters, people in radio, television, and newspapers, and they're very competitive. And some of them don't know the rules. They don't even know that they're screwing over the cops when they're doing so.
Well, and in Hack, your hero Francis X. Shepard, F.X. Shepard, Shep, we find that there's actually some advantage to him treating the cops with respect, respecting the scene of the crime, respecting the chain of evidence. Again, without giving too much away, but there's definitely some benefit to him for being.
I've actually done that myself at many scenes, whether it was a murder weapon in Queens and the 112, or the more recent thing, finding the guy was actually high on drugs, because I found the drugs in the pipe in the grass that the cops didn't find. And, you know, if you treat them with respect, they'll treat you with respect. You know, not all of them. Some of them say, oh, yeah, we'll give you the exclusive, and then, you know, forget it. They don't. But, you know, you got to proceed that way. I prefer to work that way. Other people don't. So,
you know, as we were talking, I was just thinking, as I was saying your hero's name again, Francis X. Shepard, F.X. Shepard. Is it just coincidence that F.X. is another Murdoch property? He's got the F.X. network. Is that just
complete total coincidence? Has nothing to do with anything.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, because
it's a common name that, you know, of schools, and people get named after Francis Xavier. You know, it's an old Irish Catholic thing.
All right. So it's not, there's no deliberate connection to any Murdoch property there.
No, I'm not trying to do that.
Well, because FX has historically been the network of for men. It's been very.
Speaking of movie, I thought you meant the movie going.
Oh
back.
No, I mean the network. The TV network, the cable network.
Right. Okay. No, I was thinking the movie. I thought maybe that was a Fox movie years ago with the Australian guy starring, who did special effects. Blanking his name, but it was a cool flick.
Brian something. Yeah, that was a very cool flick. It was a very, very cool flick. And Charles Durning, I think, was in that too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm getting off track. I want to just touch base on some of the things that, for people who haven't read the book yet, and I hope they will, this is a couple of interesting things that are touched on in this. We have Afghanistan war morality. We have tabloid journalism. We have veterinary practices. There's police work. There's cannibalism. And, of course, there are the practices of the newspaper restaurant critic.
Yes.
Was anything left on the cutting room floor? It seems like you've covered pretty much a very broad spectrum.
No, although somebody in reading an early version of the book, one of my personal critics, one of my beta readers, said, "Anita, this is a thriller. You need a high speed chase." And so I thought about that, and I was thinking, okay, but I'll have to do something different. I don't want to do just a high speed chase, you know. So I said, okay, I know, I'll have a high speed chase between like two Priuses. But wait a minute, they won't run out of. I gave that up, and so I did a low speed chase just for fun.
I know exactly what you're referring to, and I will not say, I will not say a word about it. But I was just thinking the problem with Priuses. I remember on there was an episode of the Showtime series Weeds several years ago where Nancy, the hero of the show, has a Prius and is able to drive very quietly through a drug neighborhood. And the guy with her is planning to he wants her to drive him somewhere so he can sneak up on and shoot one of his rivals and get away.
Oh, drive
exactly,
Prius.
And never hear. The guy never hears the car coming, and no one in the neighborhood hears the car leaving. It's very clever.
So they should have used a silencer, and even the victim wouldn't have noticed.
But why combine these particular elements? I mean, did you have particular interest in these things? Did it write itself that way?
Who the hell knows? This is what came to me. You know, I was just trying to get some fun things going, because all of these subjects I encountered in reality. Cannibals, I covered several different cannibals for the New York Post. And, you know, obviously murder, serial killers, the Zodiac Killer, for example, Rotas, and I deciphered his code. And so I had these elements that I'd experienced with it. You know, I've read a lot of books and seen a lot of movies about serial killers, and some of them are terrific and some of them are goofy. And, you know, I'm kind of a stickler, right? You know, like, well, that would never happen, you know, whatever. But I'm just trying to take something and then, you know, what if and what's the worst thing that could happen and, you know, take it from there so that this is not a nonfiction, this is fiction. And the idea is to take certain elements that I had experience with and then explore going off the deep end.
Well, speaking of real life versus unreal life, I think the big question, certainly from those of us who still consider ourselves part of the journalism world in some way, is although we're distant from Manhattan's the tabloid wars there, but how much of this part of Hack, the tabloid part, should be seen as pretty close to the truth and how much is stretched? I mean, personally, before you answer, I have to say I felt like everything was pretty close to true based on, you know, what I've followed over the years and what I've read, but maybe you'll tell me that it's a.
Then I've done my job. Because if I tell you that none of it's true and it's all made up, then that would be a disappointment for you and other people won't read it. So I won't say that. But, you know, the old joke in our business about, you know, news is like sausage. You know, nobody wants to see how it gets made, but they all love it. And so, you know, what if the sausage works went berserk? And, you know, what if it's also the technology that's available to the National Security Agency now and the CIA today, tomorrow, next week, next month, next year, that's going to be available to citizens. It's going to be available to private detectives. It's going to be available to Joe Schmo from Kokomo. And it's going to be available to reporters if they choose to use it. And in recent years, reporters have used all kinds of data searching methods to get reports and stuff on people. And quite frankly, I shouldn't know this much about you. If I were on your ass, if I was covering you because you were part of a scandal, I'm going to know. I knew a lot about you. Recently, in New York State, the news organizations had to stop using a license plate. Information, the database there, because I guess there was a lawsuit somewhere about invasion of privacy, and so all the news organizations, one after the other, stopped doing that. But that was a common thing. And should reporters have, part of the information that Homeland Security has on us? I don't know. It depends on your point of view. If you're covering someone who is a bad guy, who's cheating the public, and you're an investigative reporter, well, maybe that's justifiable. But if you're doing it to a celebrity, if you're doing it to a regular guy who gets involved in stuff, they would probably argue that you shouldn't be doing that. And, of course, the standard legally is someone, a celebrity is someone who's thrust themselves into the public eye as opposed to some schlemiel who gets caught in the middle.
And then, you know, this can go off a whole other way, but, I mean, take a guy like Edward Snowden who's been releasing stuff, and at first I was terribly offended by what he was doing. I thought he was a criminal himself.
I am.
I'm starting to come around on that because I'm starting to think it seems like there is an incredible abuse of power and technology going on that I didn't really –
Yeah, but it's all legal. It's all legal, Bob. That's the issue. See, number one, he's not a whistleblower. Right. Because who is it that – what specific person is he pointing to who has broken the law or, you know, cheated, done something corrupt or illegal or immoral? Now, what he's saying is not that. He's not saying that a specific government official abused power and did this. He's saying that in our name and with legislation from our representatives who passed all this stuff, Homeland Security, that – I think it's immoral, that the whole thing is immoral. Now, he was a part of that, and he chose to be a part of that. He wasn't drafted or anything. And then he suddenly turns around and says, I think this is totally immoral. But that's not really a whistleblower. Also, I think that this is kind of the new spying, and that the only difference between someone who says, I'm a whistleblower and releases a big database, and someone who is getting paid by Russia to do that so they can hack our codes is one word. I'm a whistleblower. And, you know, if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, and it impacts our security, which, believe me, it does, then I don't agree with it. I don't see what he's – the point he's making is not whistleblower. The point is I think – I'm making this point, but – He can make the point with a very small amount of data and a few media outlets. You go to the Times, you go to the Washington Post, you go to ABC, NBC, Fox, whatever, and you present them with this information and these documents, and you say, here, this proves my point that I think they're even overreaching the laws. But releasing huge databases, I'm afraid that that gives aid and comfort to our enemies. And he signed stuff not to do that, and I think he should accept the consequences and not run to Russia.
Going to China and then to Russia, you know, maybe not the right – didn't immediately send the right message.
Yeah, doesn't send the right message. I'm not a spy or an enemy of my
Right, country. And I agree with you completely about that part. Yeah. I've gone a little grayer.
I know, the guy's a whistleblower, he's a hero. It's like, I have a completely different take.
I'm seeing him more in shades of gray now than the black and white that I originally saw him at. But I still think what he did was wrong, and I think that there's other ways to do it. Maybe he didn't understand the history of journalism and these things.
People have handed me classified information, and at one point, I literally had to contact Naval Intelligence and say, come get this material, because I'm not authorized to hold this material. They came, they got it, they discussed it, they tried to recruit me. I said, well, I don't work for you guys. You know, I said, I'm just doing my job. But, you know, we did, the New York Post and myself as a reporter, did what we were supposed to do as a citizen, you know, and I don't think it's inconsistent with being a reporter, especially these
days. And I want to ask you about that. The reputation, certainly outside of New York and a lot of ways in New York for the New York Post, is not real good. It's not really – and I don't mean you personally any disrespect from this, but – I know, but, you know, we've just met and I
– That's why the piece is called back.
Is there anything you can say in the defense of the good reporters, the people who are doing good work at a place like the Post that, you know, that endure?
There are a lot of good folks at the Post. They're, you know, top flight professionals who have worked there and still are there. But, you know, they don't need me to defend them, and I'm not in the business of defending the New York Post about things that other people did. I defend my reporting and what I do as a professional, and I have no problem doing that.
And let's see, we talked about the cops. The thing I was curious about is the actual publication of Hack. Your true crime books came out from St. Martin's. Are you putting out Hack on your own?
My agent has told me to flip to the new model of ebook and print on demand for various reasons, but it's basically the new way of producing your books and getting a bigger share of them yourself. Because traditional publishing then becomes interested in becoming essentially a distributor, then you make a separate deal, with them, and you continue. And so I'm trying that paradigm, as they say, and I'll see how that works. It's kind of wacky in this digital do-it-yourself world, but I'm trying to keep my head above water.
I'm personally very interested in this. I'm actually taking baby steps now to bring out older books of mine as ebooks,
and
you know, it's interesting. People generally don't know, but I mean, on a traditional book publishing contract, you might get 8 or 10 or at the most 15% of that sale of a $25 book, and you do the math.
Exactly. That's why I'm doing it this way.
By contrast, if you could make 50 to 70% of the sale of an ebook or a print on demand, and
No, you get the lion's share as opposed to the employee's share. And traditionally, the publishers make out, and they had a business model that no matter what happened, they gave you an advance, they couldn't lose. And there was actually a lawyer who made a good living finding that, you know, a lot of publishers would basically shortchange authors. So this has been going on for a long time in the publishing world, and it's changed right after Amazon torpedoed the publishing industry.
It's the same thing was true for the music industry for years and the film industry. You get all this strange bookkeeping and stuff. So I was curious. I had a feeling that's what you're up to, but I wanted to confirm that. Absolutely the right way to go.
Yeah, agent talked me into using my own name, because when I took a bio from the New York Post, I didn't have any more concerns with – I wanted to keep my fiction and my nonfiction separate. It was also a sourcing issue where if I had things in fiction, especially with a separate name, while I was a reporter, people who told me stuff, cops, anti-terror people, intelligence people, whatever, stuff they tell me, it's okay in fiction. I can change it around and do stuff. If I tried to print, I basically was off the record. I can't print it, saying so-and-so said this is the next thing that's going to happen. And I'm having more fun this way. Now it's 90% writing and only 10% research.
A little more fun after, and especially when you've had a whole career of doing research and running down stories, and you can kind of, like I said earlier, I mean, you've seen enough that you can figure out how your hero can perhaps survive being trapped in a trunk with heavy weapons firing on him.
And I'm also freed of the shackles of truth. I no longer have the burden of confirming everything, and I can make it up. Although, I'm trying to do real fiction in that I'm trying to do stuff that is not beyond the bounds of reality. My next book, I sort of play with that. That's a different deal. But in these books, in the Shepherd books, I'm not going to do things that, because you read a lot of thrillers by people who don't have backgrounds in journalism or law enforcement, and some of the things they do, are just, you read it, and it's just like,
Now,
drives me nuts.
It's interesting because I just heard you say the Shepherd books, plural. So that answers my reference in the introduction. So there will be more tales of Shepherd.
Yeah. I'm going to be. I'm working on a sequel, and we'll see where that goes. Question is, does he stay a reporter? Does he become a private detective? Does he chuck the whole thing and go back into uniform? But we'll see.
I wondered. Those are exactly the questions that I wondered when I got to the end of the book. Does he stay a reporter? It's kind of handy for a lot of types of things, you know.
But a friend of his is killed, and he has to figure that out.
All right. So let me ask you before we kind of wind down here. Tell us a little bit about how you write, where you write, when you write. What's the process for you?
Well, I write here in my sort of shrine to crime. Here, you can't see stuff behind me, but they're old newspapers on the wall. The ones behind me are actually from Civil War. I collect stuff going way, way back. And I have a lot of crime things. I have you can't see it on camera, but there's a John Dillinger newspaper and lots of other stuff. I do it here, and I write to music, because music and a little caffeine are basically all that keep me rocking. And I have to admit for most things right now, it's Rolling Stones. Okay. Keeps me pumped and writing. In other things, other books that I've written in the past, for example, the true crime books that I wrote, I did primary research because I'm an investigative guy, and I would actually research everything about the killer and the victims, and I would actually play, for example, Bob Birnbaum and the surgeon's wife, the doctor. I found out that he was an accomplished guitarist, and he loved Leo Kottke and various other groups. So I would play that music over and over and over again when I was writing about Bob. And I sort of, it's not channeling, but, you know, it creates a mood. And, you know, with the books, I set a different mood because that's fiction.
Now, you've told us a little bit about stuff on the walls behind you. Anything interesting on your desk that you'd like to share with us since we had the access to the video?
Well, I can show you. You know what a spike is?
Yeah, well, they would spike the
newspaper.
Sure.
Well, here's a spike from the old New York Post. This is a short spike where people may not know how this works, but when you read a piece of wire copy, you look at it like, okay, now we're not going to use that. You go like this.
Spike it. That's it.
It's on the spike. Ergo the phrase, when your story gets killed, it's on the spike. So that's there, and nothing major. I have a lot of old instruments and a lot of old newspapers from the Revolution, Civil War, pre-Revolution, because if you're a newspaper guy, you like newspapers. You know, I behind me, I can't turn it around because it's a big screen, but there is a newspaper, the first day story of the New York World in, I believe, 1864, about the plans for the proposed bridge over the East River.
Wow.
The Brooklyn Bridge. And there's a funny line about how there are carriageways and walkways for walking among the clouds.
That would be the, you gotta love it. The High Line now?
No, that's not the High Line.
No, but I mean, isn't that the structure where they took the old trains?
No, that's a different line. That was a train line that was elevated that came in on the west side and was abandoned for years, and now it's been transformed into the High Line Park. That's on the west side. The Brooklyn Bridge is between, over the East River between Manhattan and down near where the old New York Post building used to be.
I apologize. I didn't say that very well. No, I was familiar with the Brooklyn Bridge, and several people have told me I need to come up and see. Is it called the High Line? Is that?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I've been told I need to come up and see that next time I come up. So.
It's much better now. It used to be the homeless people and hookers and criminals and a lot of rusty tracks and weeds, but it's much nicer now.
A nicer place for the hookers and the drug dealers, and
they had to go somewhere else. They have lots of cool things on the west side. They have other things that are going to be in the next book, but I'm not going to go there yet.
And does your routine change in terms of the writing, whether it's fiction or nonfiction? Have you noticed that you do things any differently, or are your habits pretty much the same?
No, it's much better writing fiction because there's, you know, like I said, it's not 90% research and 10% writing. It is mostly writing, so I get to write more, and that's better. And stuff comes out of the writing because you create characters, and when you're lucky, the character tells you, "No, I'm not going to do that. I would do this," and they suddenly say something. Where did that come from? And you know, when things happen, or you come up with a headline that you did not plan, and you know, you surprise yourself. So when it's working on all cylinders, that's when the good stuff happens.
Well, folks, listen, you can find Kieran Crowley's Wild, and I mean Wild, new novel, Hack, in great stores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. And as always, if you're watching the video at MrMedia.com, just below the video is a copy of the cover of the book. Click on it right now. You can download it instantly from Amazon, or you can get a print-on-demand copy sent to you. You can probably have it tomorrow or the next day. So do that. It's a really fun read. As I said, I'm happy to admit this. I read to the end. I try not to do that. I hope Kieran, I didn't give away anything I shouldn't in talking about the book, but it was a great read. And I got to within 10 pages of the end before I finally figured out what the hell was going on in this book. So I think that's a good thing.
That is a great compliment.
You're welcome. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Do you have a website? Are you on Twitter, Facebook, any of that kind of stuff?
KieranCrowley.com. I have not yet plumbed the depths of Twitter. I'm going to have to once I figure it out, because I have to join the 21st century. But right now, Kieran Crowley.
Not to be confused, as I learned a little while ago, with Kieran Crowley, who is apparently a very big sports figure in the UK.
Yes, in Canada, I think he's a Canadian guy. And I looked and it's like, hey, give me my name back.
Yeah, you have to be careful if you do a Google search.
I don't think you'll confuse us, though.
You have to read like every other listing, because there's two very prominent Kieran Crowleys in the world. But for this Kieran Crowley, thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Media. I really enjoyed the book, and I look forward to having you back.
Thank you, Mr. Media. Thank you, Mr. Media.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
You can see and hear almost 1,000 Mr. Media interviews by visiting our main site, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Or check out the more than 200 video interviews on the Mr. Media radio site on YouTube. And I'd sure appreciate if you'd show some love for Mr. Media's advertisers, including Stitcher. Apple named Stitcher a top 5 news app of 2011. It's a free mobile app for your smartphone or tablet that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. You can listen whenever you want to more than 5,000 shows, get customized recommendations, and discover what your friends are listening to. My own list of Stitcher favorites is pretty eclectic. I start my day with an hour of MSNBC's Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Then it's the latest 2-minute update from the Onion News Network. After that, I'll listen to WTF with Mark Maron, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and excerpts from E's Chelsea Lately and The Soup with Joel McHale. Also in regular rotation on my Stitcher playlist, The BS Report with ESPN's Bill Simmons, The TechCrunch Headlines, and The Don Geronimo Show. The latest episodes of each show, whether originating from broadcasts, cable TV, radio syndication, or podcasts, are continuously updated. Stitcher is a free app for your iPhone, iPad, Kindle, Fire, BlackBerry, Droid, and more. And show your support of Mr. Media by getting, did I mention it's free? The app at stitcher.com/Mr. Media. That's stitcher.com/MR Media. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're also supported by Audible. Check out Audible's 30-day trial membership and download the audiobook version of the book everyone's been talking about, 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Sign up for your free trial today at audible.com/radio. Again, audibletrial.com/radio. And finally, if you need a disc jockey for a wedding, bar mitzvah, corporate event, or just a big old party, please consider calling 1-800-DIAL-DJS, the party authority for all your party entertainment needs. You can call 1-800-DIAL-DJS or go to their website, 1-800-DIAL-DJS.com, and tell them Mr. Media sent you. And thanks for listening.